This is Jessica Ryder. I am here in Grapevine, Texas. I am 19 years old, and I am interviewing Judith. She's a good family friend of ours. Thanks.
This is Judith Emma Davis, and I am 74 years old. I'm born in 1945, and in Pennsylvania, actually. So I'm not a Texan at all. I was born on March 12, 1945, in Ridley Park, which I kept writing down Philadelphia because nobody knows where Ridley Park is or was. My mother was Mabel Agnes Russell Davis, born in 1912. My father was Frederick Lewis Davis, born in 1910. They were married in 1934, in the middle of the Depression. So mother had to quit college because there just wasn't the family money there to do it. The Depression really was in full swing by then. Her older sister, named Margaret, had finished college and wound up being a school principal in Philadelphia. But mother didn't get to go back. So she was determined, her daughters, three daughters, were gonna get through college. And we all did, and grad school and so forth. My older sister was born, Margaret Susan, was born in 1939. My younger sister, Karen Lee, was born in 1956, and they are still in Pennsylvania. They've been other places, but they're in Pennsylvania. When I was 18 months old, we moved to Winona, New Jersey. Population about 2,000, I think. It's a very tiny little village kind of place. We had the first private phone line in the town because everything was on, party lines. There were six or eight families and so forth. But mother worked for Red Cross, and so she got confidential information, and somebody's father had died and had to be notified overseas. You know, serious stuff came through. And she'd have to say something to the effect of, "Gladys, get off the line now. I'm talking Red Cross stuff." So we got the first private line, so mother didn't share whatever was going on at the Red Cross with, because mother was on staff and it, you know, like that. So we thought that was really cool. I remember the phone and the dial and big hand thing, big heavy phone. When I was 18 months old, we moved to Winona. They bought a big house just after the end of the war. So this is probably 1946, 47, I'm not sure. And there was a big attic that I loved and a basement, and my father had a garden in the back. We had about half an acre or something like that. And I just remember thinking it was just lovely. Flowers and strawberries and I forget what else he used to grow. I do remember 1954, I think I'm right about this. I didn't look anything up. I'm just trying to remember. Hurricane Hazel came through, which the hurricane went right up the Delaware River and just demolished things. I mean, because Philadelphia's 90 miles from the sea, went all the way up there, went past it, went up into the Poconos and stuff. And it was very exciting. And of course, mother worked for Red Cross, so the two of them, my father, went off to do, you know, Red Cross service during the hurricane and helping people get found and find their parents and, you know, that kind of stuff. And after a day or so, the lights came back on. So it was very exciting. The lights came back on. Well, they drove up, and all the lights on the street, the neighborhood, were on, but not in our house. And they come in, and my sister and I are sitting there still with the candles because we thought it was such fun. No, the lights are working. Oh, that's too bad. We were very disappointed. I remember that. We went to the Winona Methodist Church. I went to the Winona Elementary School. I was a Girl Scout. I got lots of badges, but I couldn't sell Girl Scout cookies for anything. I practically couldn't give them away. Mother used to have a deal with a woman across the street, Mrs. Baum. Mother would phone and say, "Judith's coming over. Would you buy 2 boxes, please?" Because I just couldn't figure it out. When I was 10, my father worked for the Navy. And we didn't know any of this at the time, but he was on a very, very secret, top secret project. And he was moved from the Navy Yard to what was called the Johnson Aero Development Center, which was up in Bucks County in Pennsylvania. And it should have taken an an hour and a half to drive there from where we lived, and the three or four fellows who went got it down to 45 minutes. And mother said, it's time to move. You're going to get, you know, run over on the way back. So we moved to Doylestown. And it's a farmhouse and three bedrooms and a big basement, a big attic and all that good stuff. I think it was built in 1870 or 80, I'm not sure. And a big field stones fireplace. I thought it was wonderful because you could hide in the attic. I loved hiding in the attic. Went to the Doylestown Elementary, went to the Methodist. We were in the choir. I remember in, I think it was sixth grade, the first Polaroid camera where you cha-ching and then it comes out of the bottom of the camera. That was so exciting. We were in our Girl Scout uniforms. I used to have a picture. And it was just thrilling. I mean, we probably, poor Mr. Sudam, probably had to use three or four rolls of whatever expensive stuff it was because we were just thrilled with Polaroid cameras. I went to Lenape Junior High School, got to be president of the class or something. And this is the first, I don't know what you call it, the new term is a wake-up call, but I remember, you know, when you're in junior and senior, you get sort of interested in the Second World War and the terrible stuff and Ain't It Awful and, you know, all the stuff. And so, you know, you read about what was later called the Holocaust. I don't think it was when I was a kid. I think it was called the Nazis or something. But you, oh, they're very interesting and whatnot. And about people being murdered, it's, you know, it's ghoulish. For, you know, you're 12, 14 years old, it's ghoulish. And I remember one English teacher saying to a group of us standing around, six or eight of us, and say we were 14 or something, and talking about how interesting it was. And he said, well, something to the effect of, we'll look around, because all of us could have done that to them, meaning to the Jews. All of us could have done. And we all went, oh, no, certainly not. Well, the more I thought about it, the more I thought about it, I was like, dear God, is that true? I can still, I got so upset. I'm 14 or something. So upset that I could have done that. Oh my God, that's terrible. And of course he was right. Of course he was right. But little 14-year-old hearts just were not prepared for that. But I remember it being such a shock. And such a surprise. It wasn't class, he wasn't lecturing, he wasn't telling us we were bad people, nothing. This was standing around and chatting. And I remember, my gosh, that's really awful. And then, of course, I had to read more about what happened and the fact that, yeah, there was a huge amount of involvement and a huge amount of denial and, I mean, on you know, all that other stuff. But it just stunned me. I don't even know if I told my parents about it. You know, told my mother or anything, because they lived through it. I mean, they knew what was happening. Anyway, that was like a wake-up call or something. And also, in Doylestown, they had two castles. And I grew up thinking, well, pretty much everybody had two castles. I thought everybody had two castles. This is one of them. This is the Mercer Museum. And the other one was the Mercer House. Yeah. One was at one end of, in town, and one was just at the other end of town. And family with money and the Moravian Tile Works built them, one for to be a museum, and he collected hundreds of tools and handwork things that were being sold off before the First World War. There had been a depression, people were selling the family farm, you know, so he had plows and he had tools for shoemakers and tools for bakers and tools, you know, on and on and on, and they're all in the museum, and a Conestoga wagon. He found a real Conestoga wagon and things like that. A fellow I went to school with became the curator after college and whatnot. And he said he had so many we had to sort through, pick out the best of them, and then sell the rest to other museums and people, collectors. He said we had five sets of things and six sets of that and all the rest of it. So fascinating, just fascinating. So that was kind of the first. First of all, everybody must have a castle. And secondly, that there was so much history, the big atrium and all this sort of stuff. So that's the museum. The other one, the man, the last family member, went to Europe and brought back rooms. He bought a room, had it all taken apart and shipped home, and then he built a room around it. So the other castle had rooms from Germany, from Switzerland, I think, from England, that he'd bought and sent back, big dining room and things like that. And that was the Mercer home, that looks like a castle thing. And then when I got to Europe, no, I guess it was Cyprus when I finally got to Cyprus, there were two castles in the same town, one up the hill and one in town. And I said, okay, good, I'm home. So anyway, I was an honor student, but not brilliant at high school. You know, I made the honors list sometimes and sometimes not, and not particularly impressive or anything. I went into college, and mother was determined we would have we'd have something to fall back on, was the way she said. You have to have a profession to fall back on. Somehow I got into elementary education and special education, and I lasted one semester because we were, you know, it was kind of cutting and pasting and things like that. And I thought, I really want an education first. You know, before I try to do anything, you know, teach anybody else anything, I really want to take music 101 and art 101 and geography 101, whatever. I want to do the education, have an education, college education, and then kind of figure out later. So I did. And family was appalled. And then to really get away from the family, which I really wanted to do, all families are crazy in their own way, right? So living with two rageaholics and one narcissist was really hard. So I wanted to get away. So at the end of my freshman year, I got married. And it was a serious mistake. I only lasted 5 years, and then I left for Europe. But I got my education, and I did teach for 3 years, Philadelphia School District, in West Philadelphia, which was a white neighborhood with an 80% black school. So it was a whole other experience. I mean, you know, up country, Bucks County, small town, Doylestown, which I think had 5,000 or 6,000 people. You know, big, big, big shift. So it was, I was glad I got into liberal arts humanities. Not particularly glad I got married, but I did get away from the family telling me what to do, which was the, I wrote later to the poor sod and said, this is what I was doing. I didn't know it at the time, and I do apologize for being such an idiot. And so that folded up after I'd been teaching 3 years, I guess. And so I left for Europe. I get divorced, I change continents, apparently. And I just loved it. I ordered a car. I paid for it in 6 months. I went and picked it up at the factory in Wolfsburg. It was a Beetle, you know, it was a new Beetle. And I had a sleeping bag in the back and a backpack. And I drove myself around Europe, sleeping in the back of the car and staying at campgrounds and that kind of stuff. And every once in a while in a nicer, you know, a hostel, used hostel or something. And once in a while in a nice place. But I just wanted to see. I wanted to travel around. So I started out in Amsterdam and went, you know, down through Liechtenstein and over to Germany, picked up the car, and then drove down over the Alps, which was wonderful. And I was like, because New Jersey doesn't have mountains like that. No, Pennsylvania either. And then down into Italy and around France and Spain and back up. And I had a job lined up in Amsterdam and another offer somewhere else, I forget. I think it was a military, U.S. military installation somewhere in Germany or something, I can't remember. And then I got to England and went to the theater 4 or 5 times and went, right, here I am, this is it, I want to do this. And I found work there. So I stayed for almost 10 years.
What did you do at the theater?
No, just going. Just seeing really good plays, you know, really good. No. All of the things I mentioned will be spectator sports. I'm not, I had somebody in here who saw my Bach collection. Oh, are you a musician? I said, no, it just doesn't fit anywhere else. I can't stuff it in anywhere. Going back to teaching, the first semester out of college, the principal and the vice gave me an A rating as a teacher. And I thought, no. fresh out of college. I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I had one summer's experience with small black children, none with teenager black children, none with the school district of Philadelphia. This does not make an A rating teacher. So I gave him an argument and just said, I don't believe in this. And I said, what about a teacher who's been here 10 or 15 years? Now that, you know, that's a good teacher. That's somebody who knows about what to do. And so, no, we've watched. So, okay, fine. But it bothered me that straight out of the box, I don't care who you are and how hard you work and all the rest of it, you're not gonna be an A teacher the first semester you're out. I just don't think so. You do your best and really try hard and study and so forth and go to grad school and all that, but I just didn't get it. I know why I finally left. So I graduated from college in 67, and in the spring of 68, Dr. King was killed. And it obviously hit the school terribly, terribly badly. And we teachers were sitting around just because we found out at the end of the day, and just awful. And I came into my classroom the next morning, and I hear this voice from one of the students, one of the kids, who said, "Well, she didn't do it." I go, "Oh, dear God. They think we all hate them." Sorry. And it was such a... Again, it was one of these wake-up calls. It was like, smack. You know, you think you've been doing okay, you know, we're rambling with this and so forth, but the depth of fear from that child was unmeasurable. So that was 1968. By 70, we were all out marching. I started after college sometime. I was in Philadelphia, so you could get on a bus. They would line up buses and you'd go down, or you could jump on the train and they'd ferry over to wherever it was and all that sort of stuff. And I remember, I think it was 69 or 70. I remember walking around the White House, and it was completely surrounded at the fences with nose-to-tail buses parked with nothing in between. I mean, not a half inch that you could, you know, climb over, you know, just absolutely parked. And it was barricaded in like a medieval fortress. And inside was Richard Nixon. And I thought, what is wrong with this? Why would he be fearful of us? We're carrying no weapons, we're marching, but we're not a threat to him at all. And I remember just this sinking feeling, just what's happening? Well, then in 1970, after the various marches, because of the civil rights marches and the anti-war marches, and one of the things I guess I'm proud of is I helped bring a war to an end. It took 10 years longer than it should have, but, you know, it was done by the people.
How many marches do you think you were a part of in that short period of time?
3 years. At least 6. Maybe as many, maybe as 10, maybe settle on 8 or something. I honestly don't. But it was easy to do because whoever was sponsoring it would figure out a bunch of buses and you'd go meet them at 30th Street and, you know, they'd drive off or you'd jump on the train at 30th Street in Philadelphia and just go.
Did they all bus you to Washington? Is that where most of the marches were?
Yeah, that's where the marches were. And there were also marches in Philadelphia. They were mostly the anti-war marches. And I remember there's a big square right next to City Hall. City Hall's kind of neo-Gothic pile, you know, Christmas, birthday cake or something, wedding cake. And there's a big square. And at that time, they were new buildings. They'd ripped out a whole section and they were of older buildings, a new building. And all around the top of these office buildings were men with cameras running, you know, video and filming everybody in the square. And every other one, it seemed to be, maybe it was every third or fourth one, was an armed police or army person. And it was kind of scary. You know, you're 22, 24 years old, and you go, what in God, this is my country. I'm a citizen here. What is this? What are we doing? It was scary because we, by that time, knew that people had FBI files on them. I mean, I didn't. I wasn't a speaker. I wasn't in anything. I just showed up. You know, I was a showing up person. Still am, I guess. But it was scary times. And people did get beaten up. I got tear gassed in Washington at the Department of Agriculture. I mean, you know, what are we going to do to the Department of Agriculture? And nobody was armed, and nobody was, you know, we were just marching. And people were, you know, burning their draft cards, and, you know, but that wasn't going to cause, a major whatever. It was scary times, and not like now. It's a whole different game now. It's a whole different game. It's wonderful. So anyway, by 1970, in the spring, the very young and untrained and fully armed with live ammunition state militia, I mean the not the state troopers, God, fired on the college students at Kent State. And I was a state college student. I mean, all we wanted was a degree. You know, come on, let me out of here. I'll go find work. I'll be fine. That's what we wanted. We weren't militants. You know, we weren't like Columbia in New York City College, or we weren't like Berkeley. You know, we were just state college students. You know, it's cheap, it's fast, and I can get a, you know, decent degree. And I thought, if this country is now shooting its children, I didn't know this was still here. So this ain't my country anymore. I'm ashamed and disgraced. I'm out of here. If they're killing their own. So I left for Europe again. okay, hit the road. And I thought, no, we're just gonna go see the world, because I don't like the one I grew up in. I didn't like the marriage. Wasn't too keen on the family at the time. I reckon, you know, I sorted some stuff out with the family. But no, I was done. And I sort of planned to come back in 3 months of my driving around and drive to California. And at that time, you could get a master's degree virtually free if you lived there a year before you wanted to go to UCLA or something. I can't do it now. But I didn't come back. I just didn't come back. And I barely came back to see my mother, and father had passed away by then. And no. Mm-mm.
Where did you go first in Europe?
I remember landing in Amsterdam, and the fellow in the seat next to me, I said, if you don't see me on the flight back, know I got a job. that was the extent of the planning. But I did know the things I wanted to see. I wanted to see, you know, Amsterdam and the Rhine and Rome, I went to Berlin and Munich, and I went to outside Munich is Dachau. I knew I wanted to see that, which is all very cleaned up. They really turned it into not a theme park, but very tidy. It's very tidy, very clean. And the ovens were there. Again, it's just like, what is this? So I'm 25 by now. I should have figured something out. And then down in Italy and Rome and Venice and Florence. And I don't think I made it to Naples on that trip. I don't think I did. And then back up through Marseille, the Riviera in Marseille, and then down Spain. And then up. And we were, a bunch of us from the school where I had been, we're going to meet in Paris. And so we all met at the end of the summer in Paris, 3 months. We'd all been gone various places for 3 months. And so we met up in Paris. And then I went on to London and then started to look for work. So just a marvelous, marvelous trip. So that got me hooked. Okay, I'm a traveler now. This is what I'm going to do. I like seeing stuff. So yeah, the Kent State thing just turned me off. But then there were lots of things, like, so I landed in Folkestone or something, 1970. It was the 800th year since the death of St. Thomas a Becket. And they were doing a murder in the cathedral inside of Canterbury Cathedral. And so you sat there, and the four soldiers bang on the big doors and come in after him and kill him on the altar, which is what happened. And they act out the entire, T.S. Eliot's entire play inside of Canterbury Cathedral. It was one of those stunning, not to be forgotten, theater experiences. But I mean, you suddenly were back 800 years, you were suddenly, it was kind of a new church, it was only a couple hundred years old, you know, that sort of feeling. And here we are, a bunch of peasants watching this happen. And it was just startling. And theater does that for me. I mean, sometimes you can just be smacked upside the head by some stunning thing that's put on. So that's kind of got me, I'm staying here. This is a good place. I kind of like this. I found a place that needed an American voice. They were training foreign executives, overseas executives, and they needed an American voice because they would be dealing with American firms and stuff. So I got hired on. I helped train El Cordobez of Cordobez, who was many years ago now, but a Spanish, this is pitiful, Judith. Bullfighter. He was a very famous, and he came to our senior executive place to learn. Well, he was illiterate in Spanish, so trying to teach him English was really hard. But he's a lovely man, you know, a very nice man, but didn't, you know, have a framework to put stuff and things. So it was an interesting problem. And we also, I had a very senior level class, and a man named Stan Musial came in. And I went, Stan Musial? You aren't the baseball player. He said, no, he's my first cousin. And so we had endless baseball jokes and you know, analogies and stuff after that. He said, yeah, I met him. But no, I'm not him. I said, oh, okay. And then I got a job with Oxford Press. And again, another executive center. Again, they needed one set up, and they needed it for... Oxford Press at that point was going into a lot of international work, and they wanted people to be able to come and work with them and stuff. So they wanted, we called it the executive center, but it was more academically based, that they wanted to have people who were already educated, you know, already clued up and whatnot, had probably some level of English, and now they wanted to deal with them as academics and business people and so forth. So I set that up. And then I got a scholarship. I set up another place before that, and we got recognized by Her Majesty's government in 18 months, and it had never been done before. It always took more than 2 to 3 years to get recognized, and they kept coming down and visiting. Okay, fine, you know, and then suddenly we were notified that, oh, by the way, you've been certified, you know, by Her Majesty's government. And it's almost when you look at your watch and go, what? really? We were planning to put another couple of years, and they said, no, it's fine. And so we were thrilled. We were just thrilled. It was just great. And then I got a scholarship to go to the University of Essex and do a degree, a grad degree, a master's degree. It was wonderful because I got to do all the things in grad school that I didn't do in college. I was married most of the time. So I grew my hair long, and I worked in this, and I wore jeans, and which we were never allowed to do in college. And I worked in the student union shop, where you could barter for things and trade stuff. And I got three of those, and you got two of these. And I'd like some pâté, and I'll pay for that. Yeah, that kind of stuff. Fun, wonderful fun. Got to hang out in the library constantly and drink coffee. I mean, it's just very exciting stuff. And had a really good, it was a really good master's degree. It was hard. It was good. I did not get an honors degree. I was not prepared to work that hard.
What was your degree in?
Linguistics of all silly things. but it was interesting. It really was. It was fascinating. And I did get through and whatnot. But two women got through with honors. Over there, that's a big deal. That is a major, major big deal. One of them was married with two small children. And I watched her, for the... And I thought, I don't want to work that hard. I'll do whatever it takes. I'm having a good time. So it was fascinating. And of course, I had a car, so I could, zip-zap around the country and up to Scotland and back down and all that sort of Wales and whatnot. I was headed for a job in Japan, and mother was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And I thought, probably not a good idea. So I came back here, and at that time, Pennsylvania and the Northeast was the Rust Belt. It was called the Rust Belt, and there just weren't jobs. It was turning over from industrial to, digital, but not yet quite. And down here were the Sun Belt. This was called the Sun Belt. Were the only place jobs were. So I got a job in Dallas, or actually in a place called the Metroplex, and I couldn't imagine what it was. They interviewed me in Philadelphia and said, you'll be working in the Metroplex. And I said, really? Is that good? Oh, yes, it was very, very good. So anyway, I came down here to help set up, or design and set up training program for helicopter technical staff in Iran, if you can imagine. By the time I got there, they really, they designed it like a prison or something. And I said, no, we're going to start again. We're redesigning this one for people. What a concept. And like that, because I'd had Iranian students before and I'd had, North African students and so forth. And no, it's not going to. So we were doing fine, and I was getting ready to leave, and then the Shah fell. And it took a long time, but everything finally got closed down. It just got closed down. And it was my only brush with the military-industrial complex, and I never wanted to go back. I worked for an ex-colonel who was terrific. He was brilliant. I mean, just excellent person to work for. But the premise I wasn't too keen on. And it gradually became obvious it was part of the, it wasn't going to be part of the State Department, but the State Department was pushing real hard to get something in Iran. And wasn't too keen. I was rather disappointed because I hadn't been to Iran yet. I had it on my list, but I hadn't been there. Then I got a job. After that, I got a job with a training company, a video training company, just-in-time inventory, all that sort of stuff. And I figured out that the Nazis invented just-in-time inventory. Because the trains came, they got off the trains just at the right time, and they were marched off to either housing or the gas chambers. I'm pretty sure that was the basis of just-in-time manufacturing. Very scary awareness, but it seemed real clear to me. If you build bicycles, you only have the wheels show up the day you need them and not 6 weeks early and not, that kind of stuff. Not good. Got married again. Not real smart. I never heard the term rageaholic until we started counseling. The counselor, very good man, said, Judith, have you ever heard of a rageaholic? And I said, no, I know. What's that? I think you need to go to some 12-step meetings. Would you mind? Oh, okay, sure. I mean, thick as two short planks. And I come to find out my father was older sister's a rageaholic, first husband a rageaholic, second husband a rageaholic. I just have him around, and then I get to be codependent and not very healthy. So, now, anyway, that lasted too long. But I got to be a Xerox. I got to be in Xerox, middle management, and run the training program for our Leesburg connection. We were the computer division, and nobody knew what they were doing, which was fun. We didn't know what to do with bitmap screens and two-button mouse and a little trash can and a little mailbox and two sheets, you know, that you could see next to each other on a screen. It's wonderful. And I gradually worked my way in to run the user group, which was wonderful. Just, users are terrific. They are just, they buy the stuff that you're throwing out of going, here, have this. And they make up stuff with it. I mean, they create stuff you never dreamed of it would be used for. And then they want it to do more, and then they want some more, and then, by the way, why haven't you, and, you know, that kind of stuff. Well, vice presidents are terrified of them. But if you're working with them, they're the greatest thing since sliced bread, because they invent your next three launches. You know, they tell you, well, why don't you do this? And you go, oh, well, let's just make a note on that. And you take it back, and some tech weenie figures it out. Really amazing stuff. So I loved it. I had a great time with that. One of the conventions, I had to do all the international user group conventions, and one time one of the Palo Alto research people was on a board, and one of the very, these are very expensive systems, this wasn't on your desk at home, not till Steve Jobs did you get in your desk at home. This big installations, and $42,000 for a laser printer, $45,000 for a screen and a 10 meg disk. you know, like that. And so way in the back, a customer says, well, what we want to do with ours, we want this, and I don't think app was even invented then. We want to be able to do this and that. And this very senior tech weenie next to me, and there's a vice president on the other side, says, well, that's a stupid idea. Why would you want to do that? And we go, well, what George meant was, that's a very interesting possibility, isn't it? But anyway, but that interaction, a real tech weenie meets a real customer, and suddenly stuff starts happening that you go, really? Wow. And you make more money. But the vice presidents never got it. They thought customers were scary. They could sell to them, but that's all they wanted to do with them, pretty much. And afterwards, following up, the billing didn't work, or, you know, the stuff didn't get delivered on time, or it wouldn't work with their printer, or, you know, whatever. That they didn't want to know about. And I think I just love users. I just love users. So then, when I got the job, because the fellow who had me before me, they'd never had a user group before, and our division was pretty new anyway. But the guy who was running it was not clued in at all about what you did with users and how you loved them up, and they'll feed you, you know, they'll make your money for the next 10 years and stuff. He just didn't get it. The classic example was he set up for the first meeting in Dallas, which is coming to headquarters, big deal. He set up a stage that was almost 6 foot off the ground for the Xerox people to sit on and speak to the customers who were down in the chairs in the ballroom. And I said, no, you can't do that. No. You lower it by 4 feet, and you kind of share, and they can see your head, but, oh no, that's right. Well, it's the only job I ever went after and snatched from somebody. Only time I ever did it, because I knew he'd do damage. Do you know what I mean? He'd do damage to the money-making end of the business, which is called users. So anyway, I got the job, and I thought, cripes, I've got 7 weeks to put on an international conference. Okay, I'm going to go find out how they do it in Xerox. I'm going to go find another user group, get all of their all of their SOPs, you know, all their standard operating procedures, read the whole bunch, you know, as fast as I can, and circle an arrow and whatever, and then produce a meeting for 1,400 people. So I go to Chicago. I phone up first, and the idiot fella had been there the year before and apparently blotted the copybook for our division. So I phone up this man named Ryder, who's going to Chicago, and I say, hello, I'm from the computer division, and I just wondered if I could come and sit in on, and he went, oh dear. He was not pleased at all. And I said, really? And he said, well, listen, just show up and I'll talk to you later because we got a bunch of people, you know, whatever. Okay, fine. And so I show up, hello. And he sit over there and I haven't got time. And it took me about 2 hours to find out he had a cane. I didn't know he was blind. And he's running this whole meeting, and users are maniacs. I mean, they can't find anything. They're a bunch of engineers. They don't know what, you know. So you have to kind of lead them to lunch, and then you have to ask them to talk to each other. You know, there's a lot of that goes on. And so I'm sitting over there all, I'm taking a, and he finally, all right. I mean, he's really sharp. I mean, not nasty or anything, but just, oh, God, another one from Dallas. You know, it was pretty much the attitude. And I said, well, and we sat down and had coffee or something. And I said, well, really, I came for the SOPs. I said, would you mind, could I borrow your set? Could we make a copy? I have nothing in Dallas, nothing. Nobody knows anything. He said, SOPs? You're kidding. And I said, no, we've, you know, Xerox has got SOPs for all sorts of stuff. We're forever finding out. He said, my SOP is whatever is successful is my boss's responsibility, and whatever fails is my responsibility. And I looked at him cross-eyed and said, no. He said, yeah. Yeah, that's how it works. Welcome to Xerox. So I said, well, listen, can I set... And then he explained to me that he had this idiot the week before who didn't show up in business clothes, who it told lies at the front registration desk. Yes, we'll mail you this glass thing. And no, we won't. You know, on and on. I said, I'll be very quiet. I'll really be very quiet, but I really need to see how you're running things and what the schedule is and who your speakers are and what the purpose, you know, and that kind of stuff. I really, really, please, please. And he said, yeah, well, all right, okay. Well, after, in the course of the 3 days or 4 days, we got to talk about stuff, and he explained how it evolved. This was their second meeting, I think, for this their division. And so that was in 1982. And so we just got to be friends. We were on the phone. He was in, he wasn't in Palo Alto. He was in L.A. in El Segundo, and I'm in Dallas. So I'd go, I don't know what to do. And he said, oh, yeah, I know what. Yeah, that happened to us. Okay. So he was really, really helpful. He was a good friend and stuff. So anyway, that was then. And then, so Xerox, user groups, went to Chicago. We were friends for 8 years. Xerox was supposed to move to El Segundo, ours, my Xerox division, and they offered an increase of 6% across the board to go live in Chicago in the 80s when house prices were twice as high. And I mean, it was just bizarre. And I thought, nah, I don't think so. So then he moved, Bruce moved down here in 83 or 84. And I used to drive him around with John and Jim when they'd come for visits. So I remember them at age 11 and 14 or whatever they were. And so we'd go to Fort Worth, or we'd go to, you know, in the stockyards and whatever. And so I just drove to places for him because he didn't have anybody who could drive his two kids. And get him to places because there wasn't any train and stuff like that. So we knew each other for 8 years, I guess. And I had been married when I was before, and now I wasn't. It's like, So it took us 8 years to get together in the biblical sense. And then we were good friends. You know, just plain old good friends. So, oh my, what's this? And I remember I'm standing at the other end of the little tiny kitchen. I had a little, you know, I was living on nothing. And he stands there kind of all dazed, and he said, well, we're old enough. We ought to know what we're doing. I said, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I was crazy.
It is going to end in 10 seconds, so okay, we'll go ahead and start another one.
And we'll have some.